Hello and welcome to Coffeehouse Shots, the Spectator's political podcast. I'm Lara Prendergast and I'm joined by Jane Forsyth and Katie Balls. James, you've just come from PMQs. How was Theresa May's performance today?
I think she needs a bit of humour. Jeremy Corbyn started off with quite a witty first question, basically saying, when she wanted as little friction as possible, was she talking about trade arrangements with the EU or relations within her own cabinet? And I think a bit of humour could have diffused the situation, but instead kind of Theresa May gave quite a kind of rote answer. And this kind of went on throughout the six questions, which is Jeremy Corbyn was asking quite sarcastic, quite sarky questions, and Theresa May was kind of straight batting them back. I think if she'd used a bit of humour, she could have won the session. But I mean, the telling thing, as Katie was saying earlier, is Jeremy Corbyn's confidence in going on Brexit 2 weeks in a row. I think it shows what trouble the government is in, is they have this hiatus while they basically try and work out what their position is on their future customs arrangement with the EU. But Jeremy Corbyn, who normally doesn't like going on Brexit, feels it's sufficiently easy for him to hit it out of the park, but he can go on it 2 weeks in a row.
Katie, how are relations in Theresa May's cabinet?
I wouldn't say they're frictionless. But as of yet, you have the Max Fackers on one side. Some, perhaps in the customs partnership crew, would pronounce that differently. And both sides just seem to be in this big stalemate or deadlock over what they're going to do. And it doesn't feel like you're about to get progress anytime soon. You had Karen Bradley this morning at a select committee, and she's the Northern Ireland secretary. And she was asked about the two options. And she's like, was saying, well, they both could work. They both have problems, which is all very well. But you obviously have this feeling that Brussels are looking, and we're apparently going to go to them at some point quite soon of our big pitch, and we keep saying how they're both quite rubbish. So I don't think it instills you with confidence, but at the same time I do think Theresa May so far, and this is what some Tory MPs point out, has managed to bring her party with her. It's taken a long time, but they've done it on the Brexit bill and all these other issues, so maybe that tactic will work again.
I think you can make an argument that Karen Bradley is the most important person in the government right now, because Theresa May's main objection to Max Fack is it doesn't solve the Irish border question. If Karen Bradley is on the Max Fack working group, if she were to come back and say, oh, look, having looked at this in more detail, I've actually decided that it could work in Ireland and it could deal with the Irish border issue, that would allow Theresa May to kind of retreat with dignity from her previous position, to basically say, okay, now I will move from new customs partnership to Max Fack. I don't think Karen Bradley gave much away today, and there was a wonderful moment when she said, when she was asked if she had any views on this, she said, I'm not here as a person, I'm here as the Secretary of State. I think the fact that she didn't rubbish Max Fack and was very careful not to rule it out as an option. Now, she is a naturally quite cautious operator, but I think that she is definitely leaving the door open to declaring that she's actually decided that Max Fack with a tweak or two could work for Ireland.
James, Italy's two populist parties are also trying to reach a deal on forming a government. How likely do you think it will be?
I mean, it seems very likely now, in that Salvini, who's the leader of Lega, previously the Northern League, has basically said he's prepared not to be prime minister. And that was regarded as kind of one of the big stumbling blocks, which is, you know, how would you split up the premiership. HuffPost Italy got an amazing leak of the coalition agreement between the two parties, all the kind of work in progress on it. Now, both parties are keen to say that this is old, but it is still incredibly inflammatory in European terms. It talks about the European Central Bank forgiving 250 billion euros of Italian debt. It wants a mechanism for exiting the euro. It wants a minimum basic income for all Italians to be subsidised by the EU. It says, oh yes, we will stay in NATO, but we want all sanctions on Russia to be stopped so it can once more be a constructive partner. And it goes on, and it also says it wants a kind of rewriting of the European treaties. It's basically saying the Stability and Growth Pact is not sufficiently fiscally expansionary. Now, if the programme for government is anything like this document, there will be fury in the European Commission and fury in northern European capitals. You know, what will German, Dutch voters make of the idea of the ECB basically we kept Italy going by buying huge amounts of Italian debt? If they then were to forgive 250 billion euros of Italian debt, I mean, the political reaction in northern Europe to that would be explosive. And this is the fundamental problem of the Eurozone, which is what you're going to see is you're going to see fiscally conservative populism emerging in the northern Eurozone states in response to fiscal profligacy in the southern European states. And I think this is, you know, lots of people like to say, oh, Brexit isn't that big a problem for the EU. That is true. But the Eurozone and its fundamental instability and its structural flaws is an absolutely massive problem.
I think as well as Northern Europe, you've also got to wonder what the Greek government would think if they were to go along with something like, you know, forgetting the debt, given that they weren't granted that.
Katie, we've also heard today that the East Coast Rail franchise is to come under government control. Is this the Corbyn vision starting to come true?
Yeah, I think it's quite telling that in the announcement they have not used the word nationalised. So there was nothing saying the rail service to be nationalised, given that obviously nationalising the rail is one of the Corbyn future government to be perhaps that's one of their key policies. I don't think nationalising railways is that unpopular a policy, but it definitely isn't the Conservative policy. So it is slightly embarrassing that they've had to do this.
James, do you think other services are likely to be nationalised?
I mean, there is a whole... The rail franchising model in this country clearly does not work. I think it is bizarre that you can end up in a situation where both the East Coast and the West Coast lines would end up run by the same company. I think that is a very, very odd situation. I think that the way in which rail privatisation was structured, with the track being split off from the actual running of the railway, is another major mistake. I think there's also a problem here, which is... Privatisation works when it brings in competition between different companies, right? Phone privatisation has worked, because if I want to have a phone, I have a huge choice of companies now that will provide me with a phone line, right? That creates competition that drives up standards, that delivers better results for consumers. When you just transfer something from effectively being a state monopoly to a private sector monopoly, you know, if I want to go from London to Newcastle on a train, I ain't got many other options, have I? It doesn't work. And this is the thing, which is privatisations that bring in competition and choice for consumers do deliver. Privatisations that just move things from being a state monopoly to a private sector monopoly don't.
Katie, in your column in The Eye today, you quote this Treasury source who admits there's a bit of a problem with Philip Hammond's millennial rail card. What is the problem?
So... In November, the Chancellor said that there was good news if you couldn't afford to fly by private jet, because soon 4.5 million 26 to 30-year-olds would be eligible for a new rail card, which is an extension of the young person's rail card that was previously capped at 25. It would mean they would get a third off rail travel. And it was seen as a... At the time, some people thought it was quite minimal, but I was quite a fan. It was seen as a pitch to kind of ease the burden in that age group with prices rising elsewhere. Since then, the national rollout day, and this was the national trial rollout, only saw 10,000 of these rail cards be released, which is obviously quite small compared to the apparent 4.5 million who are eligible. And there have been a few regional trials. But the problem I understand, and the big sticking point when I spoke to someone in the Treasury, is that they can't agree on who's going to pay for it, because originally it was seen to be as a fiscally neutral policy, because they thought the more people who would use, more people using trains would create more revenue and it balance out like that. It turns out that the rail companies aren't quite convinced, so they're not ready to do this yet unless they trial it in smaller stages. And in the meantime, the Treasury doesn't want to just put the money up until they work it out, because that would set a bad precedent, which is why not many people have them. And I think it also just is quite revealing to the conundrum facing the Conservatives when it comes to spending. Because there are some Tories that don't even like this policy in the first place, because Labour have a policy about giving a bus pass to the under 25s, and they don't think they should be doing handouts. They think it should be, if anything, just lessening the tax burden. So it's a tricky one for them.
I think what Katie has touched upon is this massive Tory... If we weren't writing about Brexit all the time, this is what we would be talking about, which is how should the Tory party respond to kind of Corbynomics? You know, are the public tired of austerity, and is it time to spend more money? Or is one of their kind of key weapons at the next election going to be tax? Jeremy Corbyn will raise your taxes. And so do they want the clearest dividing line possible on tax against Labour? And then allied to that argument made by the fiscal hawks is, hang on a second, we can't say you can't vote for Labour because they're just going to borrow and borrow and borrow and borrow more if we're going to fund our spending commitments by borrowing. So, you know, I think Katie's so right about the rail card revealing this wider split. And what I would say is watch to see how they fund this big spending package that's going to be announced for the NHS's 70th birthday this summer. I mean, because this is serious money. This would be way over 10 billion a year extra for the NHS by the end of the parliament. And there is a debate right now about how to fund it, which is the Treasury thinks, you know, in its classic institutional Treasury way, it should be fully funded. So it should be clear what taxes are rising to pay for this. Various people very close to the Prime Minister are far more relaxed about letting, you know, maybe a little bit of tax rise somewhere. Let's let growth take the take the strain, essentially. Let's imagine that we'll get more tax revenue in the future so we can afford to spend more. How that plays out, I think, will tell you a lot about what the Tory strategy in 2022 is going to be.
Thank you, James. Thank you, Katie. And if you'd like to read more about Italy, do pick up a copy of this week's issue of The Spectator, which sees Frederick Erickson and Nicholas Farrell look at all the political developments there and what might happen next. And if you'd like to subscribe to The Spectator and get one of those lovely moleskin notebooks, just head to spectator.co.uk/podoffer, where you can get 12 issues for £12. Thanks for listening, and do join us again tomorrow.